Hello and welcome to Comedy in a Nutshell, the podcast where I ask the people in comedy for their unique perspective on what comedy means to them. For instance, writer, actor and comedian Tina Fey once said, "If you want to make an audience laugh, you dress a man up like an old lady and push her down the stairs. If you want to make comedy writers laugh, you push an actual old lady down the stairs." You can find out more about my journey in comedy fandom on my website, thecomedynerd.com. I love talking to the people in comedy about comedy. If you like to hear what they have to say as much as I do, then please like, subscribe, rate, review, and share the podcast. Thank you. My guest this episode is a character comedian who spent the last few years creating memorable personalities such as Jemima the fitness coach, or lifestyle guru Melanie Melinda McKenzie, and this year takes Kitty Cassis to her first hour show at the Edinburgh Fringe, while also co-organising the Tunbridge Wells Fringe, now in its fourth year. It's character comedian Amy Cooper.
For asking me to do this, I'm honoured.
Not at all. The honour is mine. Thank you for doing this.
It's a pleasure.
So why don't we wind the clock back then to before you were in comedy? How did comedy manifest itself in your life when you were growing up?
Most people my age, you know, in I guess women my age maybe, and where I'm from up north, like, you know, I was born in Middlesbrough, grew up in kind of the northwest in Cheshire, and so really like identifying with that kind of Victoria Wood, those sort of sketch shows, and French and Saunders, and I mean, my dad was a massive Fawlty Towers fan, so that whole kind of physical slapstick you know, some of which hasn't dated particularly well, which is a whole other kind of, you know, discussion and debate, but just, and I guess maybe sometimes it's that sentimental attachment to your pet, like me and my dad can quote bits of Fawlty Towers to each other, you know. So it's that, I guess it's that nostalgic thing and that sentimental thing. Mm-hmm. But I guess it all goes into the cauldron of what you find funny and, you know, what you are inspired by. Yeah. So my dad's uncle was Jake Thackeray. Mm-hmm. So he was like a folk singer, songwriter. I guess he was like a Jasper Carrot type person, like a Billy, like a poor man's Billy Connolly, you know, he would be on like Esther Ranson's weekly show, kind of making up funny folk songs.
Yeah.
So there was always that as well in the kind of ether of like, oh, show business or something. I don't know, even though he was kind of like not in our lives at all, you know, we weren't sort of seeing Morecambe and Wise come in through the lounge or anything like that. But that's a possibility even.
Yeah.
I don't know, that does that figure into it? I guess it's all there for unpacking. But yeah, so sort of that satire and parody. That was my kind of earliest introduction to comedy.
So when did it become a thing that you thought would be right for you?
So really not until much, much, much later. So I kind of like terrible at maths, terrible at science, you know, very left brain creative rather than right brain strategic. And I was doing drama at school, and it was kind of in those days where it's like, oh, I need to apply for an equity card. But in order to get an equity card, you need to actually get a paid acting job, so it's a bit of a chicken and egg catch 22. So then I went to university and did a 3-year Bachelor of Arts honors degree on film and media studies. Mm-hmm. And so I could write a thesis about how to, you know, the production of putting something together, but realized really within the first 7 or 8 months of that 3-year course that I was like, oh no, I want to be on the other side of the camera, like I want to be performing. But I'm such a kind of, oh god, like a bit of a people pleaser, Virgo, firstborn, you know, you're the first girl to go to university. You know, you this is an early lesson in life that you just got to fucking stick things out, no matter how terrible it is. You've got to see it to the end. Can we swear? Sorry, I didn't check that.
Knock yourself out.
F's and C's all over the place. So did that course, and then I was obviously up north, and then I got an agent in Manchester. I was going for, like, you know, acting jobs, commercials, dance videos, little sketches, little off Deansgate type plays. Then I moved down to London in like 2000 and got an agent down in London. And like a lot of sort of, you know, young women in that era, I was in like a band for a while. I was in like a girl band. We lived in a house with CCTV cameras in the house. I mean, Mark,
okay,
exactly. It's like when I think back of like all the stuff that I did, it was like a very, very early, like it was a guy from Wigan who'd had this idea that was basically kind of Big Brother.
Yeah.
Put these people in a house. We're going to try and make them be making the band type thing. But it was just ill thought through, and it wasn't really, you know, like my dad, who has always been kind of like, yeah, it's fine to want to go and do that, but you've got to have a backup. You've got to have a safety net, get a skill, you know, like I wish that I'd taken his advice and like was an electrician or a plumber or a gynecologist or something. But I didn't take that advice. I've got no safety net to fall back on.
It's an interesting trifecta: electrician, plumber, gynecologist. Yeah, they go
it's
together.
The tripod. Yeah, absolutely. There's lots of crossover in those professions. So yeah, moved down to London and got an agent, and I had lots of hashtag Me Too situations with casting directors, and just that grimy kind of world of like, well, how hungry are you, Amy? How much do you want this? And yeah, just, you know, the bottleneck of sitting in a sort of waiting room with, you know, 40 or 50 other people who kind of look like you, you know, just cannon fodder, really. You know, I did like the Big Breakfast Weather Girl audition and kind of got quite far through to that, like the late stages of that. You know, my show reel was on VHS, but like, and I was kind of taking that around all the sort of, you know, agencies and, you know, trying to get that big break or something. I don't know. And then, yeah, I'm really downloading my whole life story here. I can't even remember what the question was, but that is my kind of background, basically, you know, performing and a bit of sketch, doing a bit of writing. You know, I went up to Edinburgh maybe 7 or 8 years consecutively from uni through to being about sort of mid-20s with various doomed productions, you know, one of them in the back of an articulated lorry that was made into a theatre space. Shout out to any of those people who were involved in that. And being really young and naive and being like, you know, just really drunk or really stoned. And being like, oh God, you know, why is John so, he's such a downer, you know, like, why is he so like, oh, because John remortgaged his house to bring us up to Edinburgh. Yeah. That the guy who's producing this show, like that's why John is. But, you know, and you're just so young and dumb and naive and just not really getting the economics of the whole situation. Yeah. But that was my background.
Yeah.
Then I kind of... you know, in about 2008, which kind of coincided with the financial crash, I was in a band. We got signed to a little label. That all went pear-shaped. Mm-hmm. And I guess I sort of hung up that dream, really, you know, and it did coincide with me sort of meeting my husband, who is an accountant, and feeling that like, oh, I should really get a proper job. You know, we'd go to his like... you know, PwC work outings, and I'd come fresh from a pineapple dance studio kind of workout. So you know, in a leotard with leg warmers, and you know, all these really like serious people with, you know, proper career trajectory plans, and I'd just be like, yeah, you know, I'm an actor, singer, and they'd be like, would we have seen you in anything? And I'm like, no. And then I'd spend an hour crying in the toilet. So yeah, it was. So yeah, it was kind of I guess I sort of put that dream to bed, and sort of I got into interior design. I started doing a lot of workshops with kids in Wandsworth. We were doing lots of like drama workshops, and I started working for Wandsworth Council doing outreach stuff, which was amazing. Met loads of amazing people and got really good experience, but always guess harboring that kind of dream to do something. Yeah. And then fast forward a few years, I have my two kids. And my youngest is maybe 4 or 5. And I kind of come up for air after like the trauma that is that. And I was like, oh, you know, have I, have I got it in me to maybe like go on a comedy course, go on a, yeah, and just maybe it was somebody who booked the comedy course for me because I was kind of like thoroughly postnatally depressed. And it was like, do you know what would be really good for you now? Just do a comedy course.
That's the ultimate cheer up, love, isn't it?
It should be on NHS on prescription, shouldn't it? You know, if you're really, really suicidal, just go on a comedy course. So what's the worst that can happen? So yeah, I guess that sort of connected me with, doing stuff again, and but always in character. So the thing with me, it was always about being in character. I have this kind of thing, I guess just like a crippling shame about like, or I don't know, just or a bit of like, I'm a white, able-bodied, cisgendered, privileged woman who like, I don't really have anything to say. I think also because my life at that point, I couldn't really weave comedy gold out of like being at home with two kids under the age of five. Do you know what I mean? Like it wasn't, I had a sense of humor failure about that. it was too real. So I came up with these characters and yeah, obviously did the comedy course and that's, so yeah, it's been quite later in life that I've come to comedy actually doing it myself.
Yeah. Because you're always playing a character, is that the actor in you, or is it more about distancing yourself from being on stage?
I think it is like the blend of those two things. Like I do love being in character. So it's not like I am escaping from myself, but there is also that advantage of like, I don't know, like I'm not, like there are loads of cool women in their 40s who stand up there and do it and talk about themselves. Like obviously I don't need to even state that. That's like, so, but I don't think I'm cool enough to do that. Maybe I might find my voice with that in the future. That has been something that I've been toying with. Like I've emceed as myself a couple of times, and that at least gives me that permission to go, oh, no, you don't need to find anything that I'm saying funny. I'm just here to get people on and off the stage, which is obviously a cardinal sin when you are emceeing. It is so much more to it than that. But that is possibly a little way for me to sort of find my voice. And I've started running a monthly afternoon gig in Tunbridge Wells with my lovely mate Jade Gebby. It's a monthly thing, and I'm trying to commit to do that as myself,
right,
basically.
So having done all your acting work and your sketches, etc., starting out as a solo, what was that like, relinquishing the company and the support, if you like, to go out alone? Did you go out alone as a character to begin with?
Yeah I did. What came just before me going out on stage and doing like the open mic circuit, I was sort of filming little videos and stuff, just little sketches, little kind of vignettes, little sort of impressions and stuff, and just like putting them on my Instagram page, really, for the local mums that I know to see me in the playground and go, oh, I saw that thing you put on Facebook. That's nice, isn't it? That the little thing that you're doing, oh, that's nice. Yeah. yes. that, you know, my passive aggressive Tunbridge Wells audience. So the safety of doing it with just me and my camera, and actually being in iMovie and even learning how to do all the little toggles and edits in a very kind of basic kind of way, was, it just gave me that confidence to sort of even pursue that. Or like, you know, I remember hearing this thing that Alan Bennett used to sit on the top deck of a bus with a notebook, and he'd just sit on the bus all day and it would do its circuits, and he would just be jotting down things that people were saying. And I like, whilst I don't really have the time to do that, I love the idea of just like, just cherry picking things that you overhear and little little exchanges that you see when you're out and about. And I really need to stop wearing my AirPods when I'm out and about, because you just go into your own world. But there are so many amazing podcasts like your own, Mark, who I'm just consuming them all the time and I'm in my own world. But if you listen to people's conversations and little, you know, just inspiration is really sort of all around us if we just open our eyes and ears to it.
Yeah.
So yeah, I started doing these little videos and stuff. And then I think I was kind of like, that dopamine hit of people occasionally like liking stuff or sharing stuff.
Yeah.
I was kind of like, oh, actually that thing of being on stage and that immediate reaction of the audience, the chemistry that happens in a room when you can immediately see whether it's good or bad or indifferent, what's happening in the room. I kind of I wanted to get back to that. So that was my route back in there. But yeah, I guess there was an element of, well, it's just me doing this now. It's just me, the ultimate of like a control freak. It's just it's only me that can kind of make it work or not make it work.
Yeah. So how did that first gig go? What was the act the first time out?
So the first time I kind of went out, that would have been like 2018, 19, something like that. Mm. And I had this character that was kind of based on, you know, like, I mean, lots and lots of people who spend all day in their Lycra outfit. They're just running and running and running and running and, you know, like exuding this sort of fitness, you know, and well-being and even... I mean, not nobody that I know personally, but obviously to caricature that, somebody who's very smug and self-righteous about sort of like how fit they are and how much stamina they've got and how, you know, but underneath they are kind of like having a breakdown. they're just, you know, they've been in Lycra since 5 a.m. for the past 9 years and everything's fine. Everything's fine. So that was my character. She was called Jemima. We had this thing called Bomb Squad.
Yeah.
I did that, you know, I kind of, you know, GMB is a night that I've kind of really, I'm so grateful for that space because, you know, it just welcomed all the weirdos and wonderful people to try stuff.
Yeah.
And it was a good year of me doing maybe one or two open mic spots a week, which if you think about the logistics of getting childcare and getting the train into London, like is, you know, it's no mean feat really. But I got to about 100 gigs with her. Sometimes when it didn't work, it was excruciating. But when it did work, it was so, the payoff was so rewarding because it was kind of like the idea is that the audience are in the fitness class and she's taking the fitness class.
Yeah.
So it was good to see the progression of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then that kind of led to into COVID. So March 2020, I was rocking and rolling. I'd had a couple of paid slots doing that on like cabaret nights, mm-hmm. you know, a burlesque magician, and then a contortionist, and then this weird like fitness instructor comedy character.
Yeah.
And then obviously the COVID thing, it locked everything down overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And I invested in this green screen and put like a gym background and started doing online gigs.
Yeah.
Really like the next week, really. I mean, GMB went online straight away. A few others did as well. Mm-hmm. And I actually really did enjoy doing those lockdown gigs because it was so much less, you know, stressful in terms of arranging childcare and stuff like that. I just opened my laptop and did it.
Yeah.
Did
that keep you going throughout lockdown or were you working on other
100%.
things? 100%.
Yeah. No, I mean, I like, obviously the kids were at home, so I was homeschooling. I was like sobbing into the washing machine, you know, and just pulling my hair out, trying to sort of, I mean, I really am preaching to the choir in terms of anybody listening to this. It's almost too triggering to even look back on how fucking awful that was. But what I had was this little ray of light at the end of the day when it's kind of like, we're logging on at 7 o'clock to do comedy. And yeah, it was, I think because my act was quite theatrical as well.
Yeah.
I think, you know, sometimes when I saw a lot of online comedy and you've got that slight glitch and that slight lag in the timing. And obviously comedy is so much about timing, but I think with this character, because she was just barking out instructions and what everybody needs to do. And it was more of a kind of performance art thing. I didn't find it difficult. And yes, it kind of kept me going, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, it kept me going. Yeah.
You mentioned about the people that you grew up with, people like Victoria Wood, and you've also mentioned about overhearing other people's conversations. Are you able to pinpoint moments that a character is born from the sort of those inspirations?
I mean, it varies with different characters. I guess There's like a nugget of something. And sometimes it can be a wig. Like with my current character that I'm doing, Kitty, it all started with that wig.
Yeah.
And that kind of like, then I kind of unlocked that thing of all the women in my childhood who would just like, you know, they'd just let themselves into the side door and just, you know, they'd just be sat at the kitchen table. And my dad would be like, fuck it, what is she doing around here again? You know, and just, I guess that Peter Kay thing of somebody who lives next door, they're not your actual auntie. They just go to yoga or they just go to water aerobics with your mum on a Thursday. They're not really your auntie, but it's auntie so-and-so. Yeah. So all these army of kind of female relations. So, but that started with the wig. and then with Jemima, the bomb squad thing, I think it was sort of, I think it was people, that wellness industry thing. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's quite preachy, but it's like, yeah, what are you really running from? Yeah.
You mentioned there Kitty.
Yes.
So Kitty Cassis is the character that your new Edinburgh show is centered around. Tell me about her.
So Kitty is kind of I feel like with my other character that I used to do, and I've done a few others, I've tried various other bits out, but with the bomb squad character where it was really like a grind. And I was like, no, I'm onto something here. I can feel that I'm onto something, but I've not quite honed it right. And you know, like I went to do the blackout.
Yes.
Do you know the blackout?
Yeah.
And it took weeks of therapy to get over that experience of doing doing a character that wasn't quite ready at the fucking blackout. You know, if you are considering going to do that, just make sure that you, yeah, I was so unready for that. And so, yeah, I was, but I still carried on because but various people who I really respect their opinions were like, no, that's a brilliant character. You've got, so the people who loved her, like, you've got to keep going with it and find, and I found, like, I had to really kind of polish the turd. and then she was, I got it, like what works and what doesn't work. And if it's a bit too condescending, you can't pull back from that. And, you know, all that sort of stuff. Mm. But with Kitty, I feel like, she's just one of those kind of salt of the earth. I'm not saying I haven't had to try hard to sort of hone the character because, you know, a lot of it is sometimes with character, it's like you've got a great character, but the material isn't there or the jokes are lacking. And I remember doing lots of, oh God, Steve Lee, who does the Mad Ron character. We did a big group of us who do like a character writing session on Zoom over the lockdown, particularly just doing loads and loads of work on like and bringing material and really sort of honing it and getting it right and having that material to back. You can have a great character, but if you don't have the material to back it up, the character has to do so much more work. But she was just sort of immediately, she's quite low status. She's quite, you know, it is definitely clown adjacent, drag inspired. It's kind of camp and silly, and as soon as you look at her, it's like, oh, we know that we can, you're fucking ridiculous, of course we can laugh at this. Whereas I guess with Jemima, it's like it was a bit more based in reality, so it's like, oh, we need to suspend our disbelief, but you're not sure. And you know, that whole thing that goes on, isn't it? You know, I've been on so many comedy courses where they say, you know, that first sort of 30 seconds an audience need to know, what is this? Who are you? What are we doing here? Especially for a 5-minute set. I guess you've got a few more minutes longer than that if you're doing a longer set, but I was doing those 5-minute sets, and within the first minute, they have to know what this is and who you are and what's going on. And I just felt that was so shorthanded with her. She's almost recognizable as that eccentric, distant relative that we all have. That's it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. I enjoy playing her.
So tell me about the show then, as it's going to be in Edinburgh this year.
Yeah, so the show is Sitting Pretty with Kitty, and the idea is that you know, she's astrologist, beautician, clairvoyant, drug dealer. You know, she's the Swiss Army knife of professions and skills, and also she's got this thing of like, if anything happened in the late 80s early 90s, she probably had something to do with it. You know, like she would make wigs for Lady Di, but would also have pierced John Major's belly button, you know, whilst giving him advice about running the country. And so the idea is that she's been everywhere, done everything to everyone, whether they wanted it to happen or not. Mm. Consent wasn't massive back then in those decades. So, she's bringing all of that knowledge into this show. And it's a bit like going to get your hair done. You listen to the hairdresser just witter on for an hour, but you don't get your neck wet by coming to see this show. And I've got these sort of, it kind of straddles comedy and cabaret, because I've got these parody songs that kind of punctuate the story. I mean, I say story like there is any actual plot, or you know, like a 30 minute, you know, at the 39 minutes we have a breakthrough, emotional breakthrough or something. It's just very silly, fun, camp kind of. I really was trying to pitch it as like just escape from the fact that the world's on fire for 60 minutes.
Kitty as a character, she's very people focused, and she's very gregarious personality. So do you build into material opportunities for improvising off of interaction with the public?
Yeah, 100%. I've got, I mean, I know a lot of people are terrified about going on the streets and flyering. I am too. Kitty is not. She wants to be walking around the streets and talking to people. And I mean, I'm saying this now. I'll listen back to this and go, yeah, get your ass out on the Royal Mile then. You said that's what you wanted to do. she's sort of... She's nosy. She's one of those nosy women. Oh, what are you wearing? What are you doing? What's going on here between you two? All that kind of stuff. Yeah. So even just chatting to people is what she loves to do. And I've sort of built bits into the show of doing that. And it's lovely when I get the opportunity to do that. And Mark, what we are both not saying here is that you saw my show in Leicester. It's very hard to do audience improvisation when you have approximately six people in the audience, but you find ways around that, and it's always good to sort of have a few bits up your sleeve that are just stock call and response things, which is nice.
And does Kitty have aspirations of hosting her own chat show? Because it strikes me that she'd be fantastic at that.
I mean, her thing is like you've heard of Blind Date, haven't you? Well, it was Kitty and Cilla Black that came up with that concept on Kiel Services in 1984. And do you think that I've seen any crumb of recognition from that? That's her thing. So her thing is like, she was there on the set of Supermarket Sweep. She was there on the set of Generation Game or any of those other sort of, she would have been there doing somebody's makeup. Do you know what I mean? I think she'd be, I would love to do some sort of, God, who wouldn't want to do some sort of prime time show of like her doing some sort of hosting thing. I love hosting as her as well. Yeah. She's kind of like, unsolicited advice central, that's her sort of thing. And I have actually started doing, it's something that I've been thinking about doing for months and months and months, but as I'm sure you know yourself, just the logistics of doing a podcast, writing the stuff, booking the guests, recording it, dealing with tech, all of that stuff. But many people do it. I mean, who doesn't have a podcast these days? So people are obviously finding a way to do it. But yeah, I've started doing Calling Kitty, which is the podcast that I do, where they're very short, 22, 23 minute episodes, and it's all absolutely untethered from reality in every way, shape or form. It's just a little sort of bite-sized sneak into her world, really. So that's nice.
Well, you have the green screen. How about if Kitty were to interview some other characters like Jemima?
I mean, if I had loads of time and patience, I could totally do like a pre-recorded bit, record that and do that. You see, this is all on the list of things that I would love to do if I had the, time, patience and actual, motivation. I know you shouldn't be motivated by the numbers, but it is really hard, isn't it, to just keep kind of grinding away, and you have to want to do it for some other reason than, hitting numbers or whatever.
So let's talk about festivals then. We've spoken a little bit about Edinburgh and mentioned about my seeing you at Leicester Festival this year. So what's your overall festival experience?
So, I mean, Leicester was really, you know, I think of it as like building a callus on your like self-esteem and your emotional landscape to be able to kind of just handle whatever situation kind of gets thrown at you. I guess ultimately for Edinburgh, right?
Yeah.
As I mentioned before, going up to Edinburgh was something that I was doing in my kind of very early adulthood.
Yeah.
And then recently, more recently, I've managed to somehow convince my husband, who I mentioned before is an accountant and I don't do math, but I've somehow managed to convince him that this is culturally enriching for us as a family to go up to Edinburgh, despite the fact that you could actually go to a private Caribbean island for 6 weeks for the cost that it would to take to go up for a week as a family. So that's what we've been doing for like the last sort of 4 years. So we go up, we see stuff with the kids during the day. Mm-hmm. I literally run out with my trainers and my backpack on and do as many spots as I can while I'm up there. And I've done that, 2018, 19. Didn't happen in 20, didn't go in 21, but did 22, did this year. Mm-hmm. And I've always been quite like, oh, this is nice because I've not got a dog in the fight. I've not got any skin in the game. I'm kind of reconnecting with that stupid version of myself who's like, yeah, you know, it's just all fun, isn't it? It's all such fun. But this year I came away from it and I was kind of like, oh, I would actually like to have a bit of skin in the game. I would like to take my show. I think the thing with Edinburgh is that it's not possible to do a run at Edinburgh any long, like even like a 5-day run or a 6-day. There's no way that you can do that and then not come away from that experience being a better performer, a better sort of like, it is like the Olympics, isn't it? Of, you know, you're honing that craft and you're like really, you're obviously getting match fit to go up there. And then, yeah, kind of, even as I'm listening to myself saying this, it sounds really wanky and self-indulgent, doesn't it, to sort of, you know, talk about it like that. But yeah, for me to be able to run my show for like 10-11 days every day, I feel like that would somehow enhance my experience, really. Yeah. I've just had my run confirmed with PBH.
Okay, fantastic.
Yeah, now that's all kind of confirmed. I'm kind of like, okay, yeah, let's just put myself through the most grueling kind of, you know, soul destroying experiences to get me ready for Edinburgh. That seems to be the game plan. And, you know, you kind of wait, don't you? You wait, you're in that limbo stage waiting for things to confirm. And then when it is confirmed, it's like, okay, all systems go. Just get match fit for it. Yeah. I assume you're heading up there, are you?
Yes, I will be there for the month.
Of course. How many years have you been going up there?
Probably, so I first went up in 2003.
Wow.
So it's been over 20 years, but I missed about 4 or 5. So I've done most of the time, but last year was the first time I did all month. I usually went up for about a week.
It's quite intense, isn't it? And it's mad to think that you can be up there for the whole month, but still come back like and be like, oh God, I really wanted to see that.
Yeah.
Or I wanted to, you know, like there's just so much on, isn't there? There's so much stuff up there.
Exactly. I mean, like people always ask me, I don't know how you can see so many shows. So, well, last year I went up for the month. The first time I saw 138 shows. And when I came back, the first thing that crossed my mind was, I wish I'd seen that.
Yeah.
But and that's after you spend all summer going to previews.
Yeah.
So before you get there, you've seen half of it.
Yeah. And it must be really interesting for you. You're just such a connoisseur of like seeing lots of stuff. And I guess at different stages and seeing the arc of how something kind of progresses or seeing it in different rooms with different, all the variable factors. That must be really interesting.
Yeah. And that's the wonderful thing about Leicester, because it's so early in the season.
Yeah.
It is nearly all works in progress. So you're kind of seeing some things are almost ready because people have been working for a year. Some things are embryonic.
Yeah.
And then you get to see that again. You'll see it in Brighton. You'll see it in Hastings. You'll see it in previews over July. And then in August, it's often a completely different show. But you've seen it grow, you know, from the acorn to the oak.
You've seen the development. Yeah.
So it's fascinating.
Yeah.
And you talk about going out and seeing shows with the family during the day. Do you go and watch other comedians, other comedy shows? Are you able to watch them as a family member or are you watching them as a comedian?
Yeah, I mean, we went to see Marcel Lecomte. Have you seen his?
Oh yeah.
So he does a show for the kids, right?
Yes, it's like Les Enfants Terribles.
Yeah, Les Enfants Terribles. Have you seen that?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, we went to see that, and obviously I'm looking around, and the kids are loving it, but I'm like, how's that working? Oh, okay, so that's that bit, and that's that bit. Because I'm just intrigued, really, you know, and really like watching like it's a masterclass, isn't it, of improvisation and interaction, and yeah, it's really, really good. And I would love to perhaps do something with Kitty, although my kids are just like so mortified by anything that I, you know, that anything they're just sort of like, you know. So actually, they're a really good audience to test stuff out. And if they're laughing at it, then maybe I could make. But we went to see, what is the, they've been doing it for years, Australian double act kids.
Oh, good. I'm trying to think.
They're always on at that. They're always on. The last few times we've seen them, they've been at the House of Oz venue that's just a bit away from
the actual. I can't place them.
Oh, they're so good. I'm really annoyed that I can't remember their. It's not the Wiggles, is it? No, because that's another Australian thing. But anyway, yeah, there's some great kids shows out there, and they're kind of working on that double level where it's also for the adults, but it is also for the kids. You know, like The Simpsons, where it's kind of, you know, the adults are laughing and the kids are like, oh, okay, we're going to laugh because you're laughing, but is there something else going on there? So yeah, that would be great to do, and also trying to see stuff while I'm up there as well, like in the evening, you know, which, you know, my kids are still, you know, quite young, but as they get older and we can, you know, go up and see more age appropriate stuff for them. It's I love that they are having that experience actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are there some of those acts, since you're looking up at them as a comedian, do they still inspire you to continue to do different, to do better?
Yeah, definitely. I'm always really kind of, I'm really inspired by people's work. You know, I think we were saying at the beginning of this chat when we were talking, just like that arc of seeing somebody's show and how it kind of changes and grows. Yeah, it's really rewarding. And I think just seeing stuff and like, seeing stuff, consuming that sort of live, whether it's theatre or drama or comedy or music, it's all going in the pot, isn't it? It's all going in and just, you know, lighting a fire somewhere inside of you, you know, to be inspired. If that's what I have asked you this before, but does it ever inspire you to get up there and do 5 minute a tight five?
I think something that Roman Harris told me was that nothing inspires new comedians more than bad comedians. I do see a lot of acts, and occasionally I'll see someone and go, oh, blimey, if they can do it.
Yeah.
I don't know. Never say never, but there is, you know, every now and then I'll think of something funny and I'll write down jokes. I've probably got about 20 minutes on my phone.
Oh, wow. Right. But, okay.
Whether I'll actually do it or not, I don't know. I had my moment in the sun. I used to be in a band.
Oh, did you?
We had, a lot of fun. 20 years has gone by. Maybe I'll do something else. But I don't know. We'll see. Maybe another time. It's not about me.
This is me trying to interview you now.
On the subject of festivals then, so what about Tunbridge Wells Fringe?
Oh, yeah. So Tunbridge Wells Fringe is... this 2024 is its fourth year. So it started in 2020 when literally Boris was coming out to that lectern, leaning on that poor lectern, you know, every other week and changing the goalposts of where we could go, what we could do. And so it was a bit of a Dunkirk spirit in that first year of doing it. And this is something that, so one of the, there's four of us who are like the core organizers, but it was started by Debbie King, who runs like a kids theatre agency and a theatre like club, and takes kids up to Edinburgh every year to do shows and stuff. And so she'd been going up to Edinburgh and was like, oh, we could do something in Tunbridge Wells. And so, yeah, the four, me and her, and then two other sort of local community spirited people, we all kind of put this together somehow. And I guess I kind of bring that comedy element to it, because I'm kind of like reaching out to people like, oh, I know you haven't heard of Tunbridge Wells Fringe, but we're small, but we're mighty. And there's a, you know, we're just, it's a real labor of love organizing a festival. That, you know, that I guess once you've been going for 75 years, there are people that can make money off it. But yeah, there's, you know, there are so many easier ways to like go and make money. So you have to do it for the love of it. And yeah, I'm really sort of proud to be able to kind of build that legacy and bring stuff to the town that is, you know, like we had, you know, Lorna Rose Treen's show, Skin Pigeon, was on last year. And then Luke Rollinson's Bowerbird was on the year before. And so it's quite nice because we're in July and we're 40 minutes from, well, let's say 47 minutes from London. I'm doing like estate agent speak. Only 40 minutes on the train. but we are quite geographically quite well placed for those people who are kind of, you know, going up to Edinburgh, they want to run their show one more time kind of thing, just to get another preview slot in the calendar. That's kind of, yeah, that's sort of how we see it. Well, that's how I see it from a comedy element. And then you've got like the theatre element, which Debbie kind of deals with. So really trying to get on the radar of those, you know, secondary schools and universities maybe that are also going up to Edinburgh, because that's a huge part of the Edinburgh Fringe, isn't it? That whole sort of, you know, the Amdram young theatre people who go up there. So yeah, we're trying to also become a place that they want to stop off at. And yeah, so yeah, it's great. twfringe.co.uk, I think. Or .com, I can't remember.
I'll put a link in the description.
Oh, thank you.
Tell me about the worst moment you've had in comedy so far and the best moment you've had.
Do you know what? I will call you at 2 o'clock in the morning when I've just gone for a wee because, you know, my pelvic floor is absolutely fucked. And, you know, just sitting there and going, oh God, that time that happened. I mean, and there are so many where you just want the ground to swallow you up. I mean, I think that experience at the Blackout, it was just awful. And it was just, you know, yeah, so... And as a performer, you're obviously so wounded and you just look at the audience with such like contempt and just like, oh God, you're all like sun readers, you know, you're all, and you've just been given power by having a black square in front of you that you're going to hold up or, you know, that is probably one of the many, many, many awful gigs that I've had. Oh God, there's so many lovely gigs that I can think of. I did a lovely fundraiser recently for PBH. I mean, I was on the bill. I didn't arrange the fundraiser. It was arranged up in, what's that little theatre-y type space above a pub near Angel Tube? Is it?
Yes, the King's Head.
Is it? Yeah.
King's Head Theatre, yeah.
Yeah. The interesting thing about, from what I've found and learned in my very, very small experience, small career, you know, I've not been doing it that long. It's not like some people have been doing it for 20 years. You can come out and you can say the same things and do the same facial expressions, and two different audiences, totally different reaction. And that can be because maybe you've got one or two people who are giggly and they've got a particularly infectious laugh and they just laugh as soon as you come on, and that gives everyone permission to just relax. And it's the alchemy, it's fascinating. And you have to study it in a lab or something one day, won't we? Just how you can come out and do the same thing, same material, but you've got that moment where it can just go either way. But yes, I did this lovely fundraiser for PBH a few weeks ago. And just, I feel like it's that thing of, oh God, they get this within the first sort of 5 seconds. They're on the, you know, they've they get how silly this is, and they get me. And yeah, I guess that's all. That's all we want, isn't it? We just weren't loved and hugged enough as children. We just want to be told that, like, we get you, we love you. Whatever it is you're serving, we are eating it. Yeah. That's all you want, really, as a performer, isn't it?
Because you said about doing emceeing, you said about being as a performer, and also about organising as part of the festival. Where are you most comfortable, running a night or performing your spot?
Oh, God, I'm really kind of flippy floppy about this. Sometimes I love that thing of, like, I don't have to promote this. Obviously, I will, when I'm booked to do anything, I mean, I vomit every single thought. You know, I fart and I put it on Instagram. So I share everything. When I'm ever booked to do anything, I will share it and share it and share it. And, you know, some people say, well, you know, that's the promoter's job. They should be doing that. But I'm kind of like, well, it's in all our interest that people come to this. I mean, yes, maybe one person might click through and book a ticket on the strength of me sharing stuff. But I always do try to, I know how hard it is to kind of hustle to sell tickets to stuff. Mm. So sometimes I like the idea, though, that it's not on my head. If, you know, like, I'm going to turn up, I'm going to do my job and then go home again. I don't have to worry about paying people. I don't have to worry about, like, getting a phone call 5 minutes before somebody's supposed to be there saying that they can't make it. You know, that's just not my problem. And I love the freedom of that sometimes. But then, you know, especially if it's, yeah, I've done quite a lot for the Tunbridge Wells Fringe, where I've put on these cabaret nights and we've done, like, fundraisers and charity nights and stuff. And it's really nice to kind of curate a night and bring something really different. And, you know, there's loads of amazing producers that are doing that. Like, 100 Watt Club is this brilliant, like, Lena Lenman, she's been doing it for years and years and years, and just, like, really finding new talent, and everybody gets a chance to kind of learn from each other and grow and share and stuff like that. And yeah, I love the idea of being a really good producer, promoter, who is sort of that everybody loves being part of their night because it's run well and stuff like that. But equally, I've done gigs where I'm balancing my wig on the back of a cistern toilet in a cubicle, and you know, and that, because that, yeah, that is equally where I'm at the moment. I think on balance, you know, and especially at the moment now, you know you mentioned Brighton and Hastings, I've got all that booked in. And so I'm looking at this, you know, these dates yawning in front of me, and all these sort of, you know, tickets that I've got to somehow sort of sell and get the word out there. But yeah, I think I just enjoy doing it. I'm just happy to be there. I mean, what I've got to remember, and this is kind of threads back to what I was saying before, that thing when I was so ambitious and hungry, but not quite enough to suck that director's cock. I was so hungry for it, so hungry to break through before, because everything was riding on it. I had nothing else. And now I'm kind of like, this is a lovely, very expensive hobby that just kind of, I've still got to set my alarm for 6:30 to get my kids up. I've still got to listen to how, well, no, I don't want chicken nuggets, but you did yesterday. But I don't want them today. You know, I'm still like, that is my, you know, that is my main job, you know, being a mum, basically. And this is just a lovely sort of little extra thing that I've got going on in my life. And sometimes I can pull that lever back and go, really, it's not none of it's really very important. And then other times, obviously, it's the most important thing in the world, you know. And but I'm so lucky that I've kind of got that lever to, you know, be able to you know, so much of it is balancing and managing your mental health,
yeah,
with this. So yeah, it's I feel very, very lucky to be able to do it.
Yeah. So what's the most important lesson that you've learned then, either at being a performer or working with the festival or as a mum in comedy, or for whatever one lesson you could take and pass on, what would that be?
There are so many. I think there's a few things, like I think even if you've got like six people in a room, like when I did my show in Leicester, and it's like you've got to just do it like there's 100 people who are all well up, like you've got to just fuck it. And that's when you dig deep and you find something. And I think you learn the most from those kind of shows. And there is a theme here, because I did another gig last night in a 50 capacity venue with only 11 people in there for this thing called FemFest Brighton, which is a brilliant curated festival down in Brighton. And it's no reflection on them that I didn't sell enough tickets, but celebrating femme and female identifying and trans women and FemFest, it says it on the tin exactly what it is. But obviously this morning I'm kind of like you've got to park that now. You've got to park that now, that like it would have been lovely if there was more people there, but equally when I was in the moment doing it there, it's just sort of like, no, this place is packed. There's not a millimeter that we could get another person in here, this, you know. And you learn the most from those kind of gigs, I think, to really kind of pull something out of nowhere, pull something out of your arse that's just sort of like going to give it that energy, you know. Those gigs where it is packed out and everybody gets it, like the PBH gig, that was lovely. But it's like, do you have to really dig deep? Do you learn something by having to really, really kind of graft, you know? You know, you really like, you, it's lovely, and I think you need those because they're affirming and they give you that encouragement to sort of keep going. And to find your audiences out there, you've just got to find those people who like that stuff. That's a long list of lessons. Park it as soon as it's done. You've got to park it, whether it was great or whether it was terrible or whether it was packed or whether it wasn't. You've got to just park that and move on to the next thing. That's the lesson, I guess.
Yeah. So how can we find out about you and where we can come and see you perform?
Well, everything is on Hire It's Me Kitty, HIYAITSMEKITTY. Hire It's Me Kitty, all one word. And yeah, all my dates are on there and lots of little videos and, you know, just the usual content. We're constantly, you know, feeding the sausage machine of content to try and, you know, just get eyes on our stuff, I guess.
And the last question I have for you then, Amy, how would you sum up comedy in a nutshell?
You did say to me the knot can be as big as you want it to be, but you've seen how I go off on tangents. I mean, this knot would have to be like, I don't know, like a, you know, like one of those Swiss medicine ball type nuts. For me, it's about being silly, escaping, I don't know, connection. Yeah, I think just being able to connect, whether it's with, as an audience member, with the person who's on stage, or even as an audience, you all share that moment together.
Yeah.
And that is like such a real thing. And that's human connection.
Amy, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, it's been really nice to chat to you, Mark. Thank you again.